I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Do you feel depressed, stressed out? Are you lonely? Do you worry about the state of the world? Do you feel disconnected from the people you care about, from the work you do? Are you bored? Has your life become monochromatic, kind of blah? You're not alone. This describes a common feature, a kind of emptiness of modern life. So what can the existential thinkers who lived through the horrors of World War II tell us about how to live with today's angst, how to embrace freedom and choice when things feel so dire and we feel so helpless? Our guest, psychologist Stephen Heine, says Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, Friedrich Nietzsche, Viktor Frankl, among others, have provided a kind of psychological roadmap for living an authentic life. His new book is Start Making Sense, How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. Heine is a professor of social and cultural psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver and joins us today on The Connection. Nice to have you with us on the show.
Hi, Marty. Thanks a lot for having me.
You're very welcome. You know, humans have always lived under a cloud of anxiety and uncertainty. What is unique, you think, about today's form of anxiety and how we're dealing with it?
Yeah, well, it's true that there's always been aspects of our lives that are uncertain, but the degree of uncertainty in our lives has been marching steadily upwards over time. Some economists put together an index, an uncertainty index, to try to assess just the level of uncertainty that's happening in the news. And they did this in the late 90s. And when they started, the uncertainty index would hover around 10,000 points. That was quite, and it stayed around that point till around 9/11, when it jumped up to around 20,000. And it, you know, it slowly ticked higher with the European debt crisis, so on. And then it just recently hit its maximum. It's close to 60,000.
Wow.
Just to give you some idea of the magnitude, of almost six times higher than it was throughout much of the early or late 20th century.
You mentioned the news. I mean, is it the news that's making us so anxious?
Yeah, I think the news definitely contributes to this, but we really are just facing some new challenges. I mean, I study culture, and one thing I study is cultural change, and cultural change has been ramping faster and faster over time. So it's getting really quite difficult to keep up with things. And so when we just see some of the kinds of changes we're faced with right now, you know, political polarization is at all-time high. You know, there's a climate crisis. AI is threatening to take all our jobs, and how do we get used to this? So I think we're just facing, from so many fronts, things that just don't really make sense. And this is really problematic for us, because if there's one thing that our brains really require for us to be able to move forward, is for things to make sense. We're trying to predict and control the world, and when it's uncertain, it becomes really difficult to do so.
You make an interesting point in the book, which is, in certain ways, we are objectively better off today when it comes to things like our basic needs. People are living longer. We've largely eradicated a lot of childhood diseases, even chronic illnesses. We're learning to live with them. So it's an interesting dichotomy that, on the one hand, I guess when it comes to a certain level of creature comforts, we're better off, but we have this overriding sense of anxiety and uncertainty.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, if you looked at any of the kinds of markers that, you know, societies typically keep track of, things like longevity, income, levels of prejudice, these have all been getting better over time. So you would think, yeah, objectively, yeah, life should be easier, but almost no one feels that way. Yeah. And I think we have this feeling of anxiety, in that one key thing that helps us to protect us from our feelings of anxiety is a sense that we have a meaningful life. And this sense that our lives are meaningful and purposeful has been eroding for the past couple generations, at least.
Well, that's why you're here, and that's what we are going to talk about. Let me ask you about something in the subtitle of your book, How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. Absurd is an interesting word, and I'm sure you picked it for a very good reason. What do you mean by absurd?
Yeah, so I picked that word because that refers to one of the existential philosopher's key ideas here, Albert Camus. He argued that a struggle that people have is that they are trying to lead a meaningful life, that we have a desire where we want to connect everything in our lives and integrate it into a complete whole. We want everything to make sense. But every now and then we recognize that things aren't making sense, that this goal that we have to, you know, to tell this compelling story about what's happening to us. And every now and then we realize that we're falling short of this, that life doesn't make sense. And when we're at that moment, he said, we're in the absurd. Things don't make sense. And this is a really bothersome state that we want to get out of.
I wonder, too, about this whole notion of anxiety. And obviously, feeling anxious is a terrible feeling. But I wonder whether it is a kind of healthy response then to the world that we're living in. Maybe it's a sane response to what feels like so much insanity.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very good point that there's a reason that we get anxious. That it's not a bug in the system. You know, it's a key feature that it's alerting us that there is a problem here. There are things that don't make sense that we need to try to make sense of for us to be able to function and move forward. However, the challenge is if you just think of, you know, over evolutionary history, our species has always faced threats and challenges, and our anxious response sort of alerts us to this. But now we're living in a different ecosystem where there are many kinds of new things that make us anxious, and we are made aware of them on a regular basis. That, you know, we're often doom scrolling on our phones, just being sort of feeling like you just can't escape. Everywhere you look, there's some horrible thing that that adds to our anxiety. And in this condition here, where we our anxieties keep getting stoked, and we rarely get a chance to process them, then it becomes really problematic.
We live down here in the United States where we talk about the pursuit of happiness, whether we actually pursue it or ever find it. How do you see happiness when talking about meaning and purpose? Are they connected in any way?
Yeah, that's a great point. They are connected. They are connected quite a bit. So actually, there's been a lot of research on this, trying to identify the differences between feeling happy and feeling meaningful. And in general, happier people feel that their lives are meaningful. And when people feel that their lives are meaningful, they feel happy. But they overlap about half. Meaning that if you drew a Venn diagram of happiness and meaningfulness, they share about half of the same reasons underlying them. And I think it's in the other half where things get quite interesting. So there are some things that contribute to a sense of meaning in life that don't contribute to happiness or might even be a net cost in terms of our happiness. So one thing that curiously seems to bring meaning to people is confronting their struggles, that the difficulties that we have in life, they're bad for our happiness, that you know, when we have these difficulties, they make us feel bad. But they also, they give us a sense of purpose to move forward. They give us a sense of accomplishment. We know why we're doing what we're doing. And there's a lot of research shows that when people encounter these difficulties in life and come through them, that they often engage in some post-traumatic growth and their life becomes more meaningful in the process.
And when it's more meaningful, if it's not happy, how are we feeling when things are meaningful? When we've done something meaningful that has purpose?
Yeah. Well, so there's three key facets to feeling that life is meaningful. One is the sense of coherence that we get, that things make sense. A meaningful life is one that makes sense. All the different facets seem connected together in some way. A second feature of meaning is having a sense of purpose, that you have a why for what you're doing. You're doing things for a reason, that you're sort of being guided by some overarching set of goals. And then the third key feature is having a sense that you matter, that your life here, that your existence actually matters in the grand scheme of things. It can matter both in your own local life, like the people connected to you, that you can be, feel that you matter in that way, but also the sense that sort of in the grand scheme of things, that your existence is somehow contributing something to the universe.
The show is called The Connection, and you write the connections seem to be, and when you think about it, really are at the root of a well-lived life, whether it's connections to the people we love or to the work we do or to our community. The connections are so important. Is that because we're social creatures? We want to belong. We're tribal that way?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So I think first, just thinking of what meaning is, I think meaning ultimately is about connections. So if you think of anything, what does anything mean? What does your radio show mean to you? It's all of the ideas that you connect to it. It's all of the moments that have made you proud. It's all of the difficulties you've had, all of the guests you have, the people you work with. All those things that you connect to your radio show are what give it meaning to you. And if any of those changed in a dramatic way, so would your sense of what your show means to you.
Right.
And it's a similar thing with our lives. It's the kinds of things that we connect to our lives that make our lives feel meaningful. And I think this does come out of us being one way that humans are a unique species is that we are the only truly cultural species. Some other species have some degree of culture learning, but culture is wrapped up in everything that we do. And so what that means is that even though as a species we share the same set of basic needs, all humans have that, we need to get protect ourselves, we need to get resources, we need to, attract a mate, and so on. But we do all of these things in culturally wrapped ways. That is, we learned particular ways from our culture of what is the of what is valued, of what is appropriate, and what is condoned. And so, our species, we are always sharing information with each other, and we create a sense of shared norms, which ultimately become our cultures. And these provide us with the standards that we evaluate our lives with. Am I living a good life? Is my life make sense? And we're comparing it with these cultural ideals of how we learn that what is an appropriate life. And in different places around the world, people lead their lives quite differently, and they compare themselves to quite different standards.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with psychologist Stephen Heine. And he's got a brand new book. It's called Start Making Sense, and it's subtitled How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. And again, we've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, our guest is psychologist Stephen Heine. And again, he's got a new book called Start Making Sense. And we are talking about existential psychology. Let me quote Jean-Paul Sartre, who you quote in this book. Man is condemned to be free because he did not create himself. Free because once cast into the world, he is responsible for everything he does. You also have another quote here. There is no traced out path to lead man to his salvation. He must constantly invent his own path. But to invent it, he is free, responsible, without excuse, and every hope lies within him. I underscored those both because that feels like a lot of work. That feels like a really heavy lift to be free and responsible and to, you know, pursue one's life in that responsible kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's somewhat paradoxical because, you know, we celebrate our freedoms, right? That we love the idea of freedom, to have the freedom to choose. And there's very few freedoms that I think people would be willing to give up. But I think what Sartre recognizes there is that having these freedoms, it comes paired with responsibility. That if we are free to lead our lives as we wish, that ultimately means we're responsible for the lives that we lead. And this is a great deal of responsibility, and it can bring about a lot of anxiety. And in other cultures and other times, there really weren't as many choices available to people as there are now. Now we can, at many universities, students are allowed, to choose to make a custom major where they decide what set of courses they're going to take. That there's no sort of official guidance about these are the requirements here. There are so many different kinds of job possibilities and people having a bunch of side hustles to cobble together some income. And, dating now, people are on apps where they have thousands of possible choices. And somehow we're supposed to get it right. And if just comparing the situation that we're now to earlier times, in most of the world throughout past several centuries, people were farmers. And the idea of, living in such an environment is, what are you going to do with your life? Well, you're going to be a farmer. That's like kind of the only real option in that community. And that's something you don't need to struggle to figure out. Am I on the right path? Am I pursuing the right career? And I think we haven't really appreciated just how much anxieties that come paired with these freedoms that we love.
Well, it seems that freedom is so important to existentialism, to understanding what existentialism is. But just picking up on what you just said there, whether do too many choices lead to freedom or does it lead to paralysis or confusion or anxiety?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Soren Kierkegaard said, anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. Yeah. And I think he really gets this right, where if you're just thinking that at any point, it's up to you, you can choose what to do. That sounds great. But now you have to figure out, well, what is the best choice that I can have? And I think something that's quite telling is to look at adolescent angst, and adolescent anxiety is at in the U.S. in particular is the highest that it's ever been measured. And we tend to think of adolescence as being an especially difficult time, time of storm and stress. But I think something that's quite striking is adolescence is not the same problem everywhere. Yeah. And for instance, some anthropologists reviewed about 100 small-scale subsistence societies around the world. And in the vast majority of these societies, they don't think adolescence is a difficult time. They don't have that idea that during adolescence, it's going to be a difficult time. And where you find adolescence being the most difficult is in industrialized, individualistic cultures, where people are said that you need to figure yourself out. You have so many choices and you need to, forge a path ahead and to live your own unique life. And it's very exciting, but it makes people anxious.
Well, there is a word for that, which I did not know. Weird. Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. These are the teenagers who are struggling with the sort of anxiety in their life.
Exactly. I think an unappreciated, I think generally psychologists thought, well, adolescence is an anxious time because, you know, you have raging hormones, and that certainly contributes to the fire. I think it's fuel to the fire. But added to that is this idea now that you need to figure yourself out, and it's an uncertain time, and there's so many different ways. And I think social media is making it that much more difficult, comparing your life to all of these beautifully curated lives, impossibly beautiful lives that others seem to be having. It's making people extremely anxious.
What are some of the key existential questions that you think people should be asking themselves if they want to live a life of more meaning and more purpose? If they feel a kind of emptiness, that something is not right?
Well, I think it helps to really understand, what is the sort of foundation of a meaningful life. And earlier we were talking about how connections lies at the basis of this. And I think there's certain kinds of connections that are especially linked to having a meaningful life. One important kind is our interpersonal connections, so that people who generally feel well socially connected tend to report feeling more meaning in life. And one of the most corrosive aspects to a meaningful life is feeling lonely. And some kinds of relationships seem to be especially important to providing that meaning. So family relationships are actually especially important for providing a sense of meaning, because it provides you also with a sense of identity. Sort of you have kind of a life history, like your ancestry going back in time. You have some shared features in common with other people in your family, and they're usually lifetime relationships. Also, relationships where people take on a caretaker role. These are especially conducive to leading a more meaningful life. So whether you're taking care of the elderly, taking care of pets, or taking care of your children, these are all things that contribute to a more meaningful life. So these interpersonal connections are important. Another kind of connection, related kind of connection that's important, is feeling connected to a community. So when we feel that we belong to a community, we have sort of a sense of shared identity and a sense of shared purpose with our community. And this really bolsters our sense of meaning. Another kind of connection that matters is our connections to our work, that our work provides us with a sense of purpose and a sense that we're having some impact in the world, and comes with social relationships as well. A fourth kind of connection that's especially important, and I think it's one that is perhaps been underappreciated in science, and I think also by the original existentialists, is that our connections to the transcendent realm have been found to be especially important for predicting whose life feels meaningful. When people feel that they're connected to something beyond the material world, that there's more to the world than that what meets the eye, people who have these beliefs tend to view their lives as more meaningful.
Do
So
you
I think
think,
these are important.
yeah, and I appreciate all of that. Do you think it's important to ask ourselves, these basic kind of philosophical questions? Why am I here? What do I value? What does my life mean? I mean, kind of takes me back to college when we struggled with all these questions. But do you think these are the questions that should help guide our lives?
I think I do think it's a double-edged sword, because I do think you're never going to get a great answer to
Right,
those
exactly.
questions, right? You will ponder them, and they're very interesting, and you can come up with answers that are make your life feel more meaningful. But I also think that an obsession with them is where it can be a little risky too, that you can get chased down a rabbit hole and trying to figure, well, really, ultimately, why am I here? I think in general, it's good to focus on these elements that we know do link with more meaningful lives. And so finding things that give you a sense of purpose, and attending to these key connections in your life, trying to build them where you can, I think these are the ways of leading a more meaningful life.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's psychologist Stephen Heine, and he's got a new book we're talking about, Start Making Sense, How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. And again, he's a professor of social and cultural psychology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Existentialism really grew out of the Second World War, the horrors of the Second World War, and even some of the things that came after that. How did that shift, I guess, our thinking about how to, again, lead a life of meaning and purpose on the planet? What were the existentialists telling us?
Yeah, well, I think it is important to note just, yeah, the times that they came out of. Like we talk about now being a very uncertain time, and the middle of the 20th century, just coming out of, you know, the worst economic crisis in modern history, the most destructive war ever, and then the beginning of the Cold War, yeah. That this was a time of great uncertainty, and this is when their ideas came out. And I think some of the key kinds of questions that they were interested in is one, you know, how is it that we cope with and find meaning in our lives when we reflect on the uncomfortable fact that all of our lives are going to end, that we're all here just for a brief instant. And there's nothing that you can do to change that. You know, it doesn't matter how much kale juice you do or how many steps you get in a day. Maybe at best you'll delay it a little bit, but in the like, our lives are finite. And so that was one of the key questions that they're interested in, is how is it that we cope with this sense that our lives here are finite.
Let me ask you about Viktor Frankl again. You wrote about in the book for obvious reasons. He survived, I believe, 4 Nazi death camps. He lost his parents. He lost his wife. He lost his brother. I mean, he lost, I guess, everything. And yet, yeah, out of his experiences there, he was able to create this whole existential look at meaning and purpose. You write that he wanted to complete a book. The manuscript had been destroyed. He was in Auschwitz, I believe, and wanted to complete this book. And that sort of gave him this sense of purpose. I'm going to complete this book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite striking. It's an unfathomable amount that he lost in going through the camps here. But he attributes that one particular loss, losing his book manuscript in the disinfection chamber at Auschwitz, that gave him a reason to live, that this is something that he wanted to recreate this book. It was his very first book. And that gave him something to live for. And one thing that he noticed in Auschwitz and the other concentration camps there is that you could see that some of the prisoners were faring much better than others. And the ones who tended to be doing well seemed to have some sense of purpose, some reason to live. And he likes to quote Friedrich Nietzsche, who says, "He who has a why to live for can withstand any how."
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So having that sense that there's a reason behind what I'm doing. And that's something that I think that we really need to cultivate, to find this sense of purpose. Because even in the most threatening, meaningless situation you can imagine, you know, being in a concentration camp where everything about your existence is being threatened, your family, your ethnicity, your religion, everything's being torn apart. And even in that environment, he was able to find a reason to pursue, a reason to make his life meaningful.
Well, he talks about will to meaning. Is that sort of like the will to live, the will to meaning?
Yes, very much. He said it's like a will to find something that will give your life meaning. And he argues that we this is something that we have to pursue, because he talks about that there are many kinds of situations where the foundations of meaning are hard to come by, which he calls an existential vacuum. In that kind of situation, we need to make our own meaning. And I think right now, an existential vacuum is a pretty apt description for what many of us, the kinds of lives that many of us are leading now. Like, if you think of these key kinds of connections that I was talking about earlier that lead to a meaningful life, all of these kinds of connections have been under assault for some time now. That people are far less likely to be social with others, that people are they're having family dinners less often, they're seeing their neighbors less often, people have fewer friends than they used to. So we're losing that set of connections. People's connections with their community have been undermined for a long time. That, you know, people used to belong to community organizations like a Rotary Club or belong to like a, you know, a community sports league, and they're far less likely to do so now. We're losing our connections to our work, that the people changing jobs more often, they're cobbling together some side hustles. And with, you know, after the pandemic, people are working remotely, there's kind of disconnected from their community, and we're facing AI taking away our jobs. And then also people have been losing connections to the transcendent, and that most industrialized countries around the world have been rapidly secularizing, and people moving away from having belonging to organized religion. And so all of these key bases of that provide a sense of meaning in life have been eroding, and it makes it all the more important for us to make the efforts to build meaning in our own lives.
Well, that's a very dire and depressing description about the world that we live in today. But I wonder whether are we more resilient than we give ourselves credit for? You talk about post-traumatic growth, that oftentimes out of trauma, people actually overcome it and maybe even create a better life for themselves.
Yeah, this is something I think very encouraging and perhaps somewhat ironic, that the encouraging news is the most common outcome for people who face horrible trauma in their lives is to experience post-traumatic growth, that most people come out stronger. And so we are more resilient than we realize. And there's a few reasons why people often come out stronger from their trauma. One, it makes you appreciate your relationships more, that you become more dependent on your social support network, and you sort of appreciate just how you are, you know, part of this network of relationships that are taking care of you. Two, many survivors often come to devote their lives to often, well, to a cause, often the cause associated with their own trauma and loss, so that they find a new sense of purpose. People also are more likely in aftermath of trauma to grow spiritually, and that they're more likely to get involved in their religion or spiritual practices. And people then also learn about these inner strengths that they didn't realize they had. It's sort of like a hidden superpower that I'm certain I would be crushed by this, but the most common reaction people have is that they emerge stronger and they grow from it.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And frankly, that is good to know that we have this resilient core that can help us through some tough times. And again, talking with psychologist Stephen Heine. And again, he's got a new book we're talking about. It's called Start Making Sense. And it's subtitled How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. And it often does feel as if we are living in absurd times. Much more to talk about after this very short break, including our brains and our sense-making system. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Do you feel on edge? Are you anxious about the state of the world? Are you worried about how to live your life in a way that matters? You are not alone. Today on The Connection, our guest is psychologist Stephen Heine, and we're talking about his new book called Start Making Sense. Stephen, you write in this book, our brains have evolved what I call a sense-making system, that there's something in our brains that helps us to make sense of this, what often feels like nonsensical world. How does that work?
Yeah, well, so first, it's important to realize just how important it is that we make sense of things, that ultimately we need to predict the world such that we can control it, so that we can, you know, work towards satisfying our basic needs. So it's of vital importance that we make sense of things. And often, though, we encounter things that don't make sense, that are nonsensical, that are absurd, and we're left kind of at a loss for what to do. And what our research has pointed to is that there does seem to be this sense-making system, that when we feel that there's a lack of sense, when we feel that things are meaningless, this prompts us to seek out meaning elsewhere. It prompts us to try to understand what is the underlying problem here that is causing us to feel that things are meaningless. And it's somewhat of a homeostatic system here. Meaning that it gets sort of turned on when it notices that that we have an insufficient amount of meaning, and as long as we can find meaning somewhere, then it gets rid of this bothersome feeling that we're experiencing to allow us to feel that we can move forward again.
Does that mean that meaning is sort of hardwired? I'm thinking of dopamine, a kind of reward system. If you're feeling that sort of pleasure and connection, whether the brain is rewarding us with chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely our reward centers are activated when we get the sense that things are meaningful. But I think it's actually prompted more by the feeling that when we lack something. So just as an example of how this homeostatic system can work, I want to just consider one sort of kinds of feelings that we sometimes get, that we feel nostalgic. Our feelings of nostalgia, I think, are quite telling to how our sense-making system works. So when we feel nostalgic and sort of we reflect back on our past, look at earlier chapters of our life story, that this tends to be the feeling that we get. It's kind of a bittersweet feeling, because on the one hand, the bitter part is that these are times from the past that are no longer there. But they're sweet in that they, one, remind us of these connections that we've had, and they help us to understand our life, that they help us to understand the kind of person that we become. So when people reflect nostalgically, they show a boost in their feelings of meaningfulness. However, what I think is telling about this is that we're not equally likely to feel nostalgic at all points in time. Rather, people tend to feel more nostalgic at a time when they're feeling that their life isn't sufficiently meaningful, when they're feeling lonely, when they're feeling disconnected. This is when we often go into a nostalgic reverie, and we flip through an old photo album or listen to a soundtrack from our past, and we have those nostalgic feelings, and that boosts us back up. It restores us to the state where we feel that things are meaningful again. So it's an example of how when we notice this deficit, we respond and we search for a sense of meaning elsewhere. And it can be something completely disconnected from what might have caused our original feelings of loss of meaning, and it restores them.
Do you think we are reliable narrators of our lives? I mean, nostalgia, you know, often is tinged with things that might not be true, or how we've sort of rewritten our past to fit a kind of narrative.
Yeah, well, I think ultimately we understand our lives and probably everything in terms of a narrative, that it feels like we're connected with reality and that what we see is what we get, but we are always interpreting it through a particular narrative, that we're connecting different parts of our lives, that we're saying that thing that happened to me 10 years ago is connected to this thing that's happening to me now. Like, we're making the connections, we're telling the story, and we rely on these stories. They're a very important way that we make meaning in our lives, because they help us to connect all the otherwise contradictory parts of our lives and help them to fit together into a narrative that provides some sense. It provides a sense of coherence. And yes, sometimes our stories might depart from reality. I maybe
Does that
often
matter? Does
they
that
do.
matter?
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, obviously, if you become too disconnected to reality, that can be very problematic. But I think these minor tweaks that we do, and we're not even aware that we're doing, are what help us to connect these parts that otherwise would remain unconnected, and it helps us to move forward. And so, there's a lot of research in psychology about how narratives help people provide them with a sense of meaning and coherence. And some of these kinds of narratives are better than others for providing us with a sense of meaningful life. And what studies have found is that people can learn how to tell their life narrative in a way that is more constructive. We're not like, yes, we can't change any of the events that have happened to us in the past, but we can change the way that we think about them. We can change the way that we connect them, and that we can tell a more constructive life story, which helps to provide us with a sense of meaning and helps us to confront the anxieties that we experience.
You say that we tend to tell our story with the belief that I am a good person. I mean, that sort of drives the narrative, even, I guess, on the times that we have not been such a good person, but that's the sort of overarching theme of our life. And we're the hero of our narrative, for sure.
Exactly. I think there's a number of sort of key premises that are common to the vast majority of people's stories. And one of them is, yeah, I am good. That we interpret the events in our life, most people do, not all, but most people do, in a way where they come out looking good. That, it was unfair the way that people treated me. I deserve better. That I accomplished good things. That we have, this is the filter that most people look at their lives through, and they remember their, on average, people remember their successes better than their failures. They take credit for their successes and blame others for their failures. And this actually, research suggests, is quite healthy, at least to a degree. A minor tweaking. It's not broad delusions, just minor tweaking to these things, like rounding up when we're looking at what we've accomplished, is one thing that helps people to move forward, and it helps to provide them with a more positive, encouraging life story.
Well, let's talk about mortality, something that you mentioned earlier. And again, I will quote from Viktor Frankl from your book. He said, "If we are immortal, we could legitimately postpone every action forever. It would be of no consequence whether or not we did a thing now. But in the face of death, we are under the imperative of utilizing our lifetime to the utmost, not letting the singular opportunities pass unused." That knowing that death is hanging over our head forces us, I guess, in a way, to live our life, to make decisions, to find things that matter.
And I think this is something perhaps unexpected too, because yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want more life
Right, to live
if it
forever,
was
right?
offered? Yeah, it seems like that's the dream, to discover the fountain of youth, live forever. But as Frankl was saying, the problem with immortality is that there would never be, well, one, things would get pretty boring. I mean, how many, it's after you've done your 20,000th show, maybe it would start getting a little repetitious, and yeah, you might. But also just the feelings of scarcity. Scarcity, is quite striking. Scarcity makes everything more valuable. Knowing that this moment, we will never have this moment again, that this is kind of a one-time moment and that it's going to be gone, that boosts a sense of a value to it. And so one common experience that many people have when they face a near-death experience, when they've just avoid like they maybe they've had like a cancer diagnosis that they've gotten over, maybe they just missed being in a horrible accident, is that people often come out of that with this increased desire to savor life, that they've just realized just how precious life is, the fact that it can be gone at any moment. And I think this is an important thing to recognize, yeah, just to appreciate that yes, the clock is ticking, but that sort of reminds us of just how precious the moments are that we have.
You quote, and this is the bombing of London during World War II, that the people who survived that bombing often felt very emboldened, very, wanting to, I guess, defy the Nazis, but sort of determined to live on their life.
Well, I think of these kinds of situations when people miss being hurt, that they're in a situation where they think they're going to die, when they think it's going to be devastating, and they emerge unscathed, that this leads to this remarkable reaction of people feeling more invulnerable and more empowered from it.
You talked about religion and spirituality, and I guess, searching for that sense of awe, how important that is to living a well-lived life. And you also talk about the fact that you left the religion, I guess, of your childhood, feeling it did not answer, I guess, the questions you had about how to live a good life. Where do you draw then inspiration? Where do you get that sense of spirituality, of the things that are larger than yourself?
So first, I would just like to highlight that I left my religion, a group, fundamentalist Baptist, and many people are leaving religions, and this can sound like a dire situation. Then that, given that, as I was saying, these spiritual connections are so important to us, are we facing like a worldwide existential crisis as the world is on this path towards secularization? But what's important here is that organized religion is not the only way that people can connect spiritually. And the fastest growing category of belief in the US and in many other industrialized societies right now is the group that's been labeled a spiritual but not religious. So that people are finding their own spiritual connections outside of an organized religion. And people often are taking kind of a buffet style approach to this, where they're saying, well, I'm going to take some of these pagan rituals here, maybe a little Zen meditation here, maybe some astrology, and they're putting this together. They're using, we talked about all the freedoms that people have. Well, these freedoms now seem to be extending into the hereafter, and people are sort of figuring out how they're going to figure out their spiritual needs. And so I put myself in that category, that I still do have quite spiritual feelings, that I do feel that sometimes this sense of connection to the universe, and I do try to cultivate those experiences when I can, because I feel that they're really quite replenishing. And I encourage people, given this research that shows just how strongly linked these feelings of spiritual connections are to a sense of a meaningful life, to try to be open-minded. And that when you encounter something that, largely fits with your worldview, that might be a little non-material, that might sort of take things out of the material world that you're familiar with, that to be open to that, because on average, a lot of research is finding that this is associated with greater feelings of meaning in life.
I was thinking about this search for meaning, which we've obviously been talking about for this program. But if something is not true, I'm thinking of people believe conspiracy theories or believe in QAnon, and people clearly do, and have built their life around this thing that means something to them, but is totally wrong. How do you reconcile that?
Well, that is a real challenge that we face, and we've It's especially a challenge we face now in this age of misinformation, where it's that helps to sustain these kinds of conspiracy theories. But I do think that these theories are providing these people who have them, that whatever your beliefs are, that they are providing a foundation for you to understand the world and are important to you. I think it's I agree that there's so many conspiracy theories. People are deeply disconnected from the truth. I do think we're all somewhat disconnected from the truth, though, that we are all leading our lives through a particular narrative, that we have a particular framework that we interpret things. And I would just say that, yeah, when you are dealing with people who, you're convinced are quite have bad information and that is, supporting these conspiracy theories. I think the best way to approach them is to approach them that we each have something to learn from each other. I think that the problem is that people are very quick to say that, your worldview is all wrong and my worldview is all right. And so you have nothing to say that I can learn from. And I think this is what's deepening these troughs that's separating us into this highly polarized space. And I think I'm always struck that when I meet people who have different political views from me, that when I imagine these people, I imagine them to be really quite horrible people. But when I meet them and talk to them, realize they're wonderful people, they're warm, engaging people, and we just have different worldviews. And when you can talk to them one-on-one, not definitely through social media where it only brings out the worst in people, that you can find the common ground that you do have, and in that place, people are more receptive to hearing ideas that they disagree with.
We have no time, but I wonder whether this has brought us full circle, whether conspiracy theories come out of the anxiety and the anxious world that we
Yes.
are living with.
There's a lot of research pointing that out. When people are more anxious, they need a source of explanation. And the value of conspiracy theories, they're simple explanations. It's, you know, it's, there's, yeah, some conspiracy controlling everything. That's why the world is as it is.
Well, Stephen Heine, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. A lot of fun for us as well. And again, the book is titled Start Making Sense: How Existential Psychology Can Help Us Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. He's a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.